All right, we're on to the merits docket, and I expect that it's already been attended to, but please make sure that you've signed in. And we're ready when you are for the case of Tyrone Conway versus the Commonwealth.
Good morning, Your Honors. I beg the court's grace today. My in-laws are in town, so. Your Honor, this matter comes from the Lancaster County Circuit Court, a conviction of malicious wounding under 18.2-51. My name is Will Hubbard of Hubbard, Terry, and Britt, and I represent Tyrone Conway.
Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal, sir?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. 2 minutes.
2 minutes?
Yes, sir.
Very well.
Your Honor, I would note that this case presents two questions of law, primarily. Whether the evidence of the injuries sustained by Mr. Norris and the manner in which they were inflicted are sufficient as a matter of law to constitute wounds for purpose of Virginia law, and whether the indictment sufficiently charged the appellant with an offense for which he could be tried and convicted, given the facts taken in a light more favorable to the Commonwealth.
To the extent that the wound requires a break in the skin. There was bleeding here, and so that part is satisfied.
Your Honor, I concede that there's the wound as far as a breaking of the skin. Yes, sir. I'm not arguing that nature in the definition of wound.
But it's the weapon versus parts of the body.
Yes, sir, Your Honor. Yes, sir.
Wasn't that dicta in that 1928 Harris versus Commonwealth?
Your Honor, I believe it was, but it was emphasized, and I know it's been recited in several cases since then.
Cited by Professor Bassigal in his treatise.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
But are there any other cases where it's been applied?
Not to which I'm aware, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yeah, but I believe Your Honor is correct in that it was recited by Professor Bassigal as well. Your Honor, in this case, I think the evidence doesn't support the malicious wounding conviction, although the indictment for that charge is properly drawn. Conversely, the defendant was not properly charged in the indictment with a malicious bodily injury charge, although the evidence is consistent with that charge. The injury was precipitated by the use of defendant's fists in taking Mr. Norris. They'd been riding around earlier in the day, took him out of the truck. They'd gotten into an argument, which resulted in my client, Mr. Conway, using his fist, beating on Mr. Norris several times, which resulted in Mr. Norris having severe injuries, and I concede the injuries were severe. Your Honor, the court is aware that the statute constitutes four separate and distinct offenses: malicious wounding, unlawful wounding, malicious injury, bodily injury, and unlawful bodily injury. Virginia has adopted the definition of wound, as the court referenced a moment ago, from State v. Gibson, stating that it's an external breaking of the skin caused by violence with a weapon other than that which man is endowed with: fists, feet, knees, so on.
But we have so many cases that, although they've not focused on that particular issue, where we've repeatedly said that under certain circumstances, striking of the fists is enough to satisfy, I guess it's the intent requirement for malicious wounding.
Yes, sir, and that's, I've looked at cases, and I know the Attorney General's office has provided me with a case that they are likely to reference in their argument later, which goes to that fact as well and that issue. We're not arguing the intent aspect of it. We're arguing the very specific definition of wound versus bodily injury. And I'll note in the case that I believe Mr. Stallard will present, it does state malicious wounding is defined as, and then it goes on to say, any kind of wounding or bodily injury. So that term, malicious wounding, under the statute seems to encompass both of those definitions, even though they are separate and distinct offenses.
Can I ask you about Rule 3A:9?
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
And the 7 days and the fact that this was not raised to the court.
Yes, sir.
Within that 7-day period, why doesn't that sort of take care of the first two assignments of error or moot them out? Because if that was not properly done, Wouldn't this court have to believe that no crime at all was charged here rather than just it wasn't specific enough in the indictment? Because if it's not specific enough, then you're into the 3A:9, aren't you? And then you can amend the indictment.
Your Honor, my argument on that point is that were the evidence justifying a malicious wounding or an unlawful wounding conviction, then the indictment as it stands is perfectly proper. That properly charges wounding. It doesn't need to make reference to the instrumentality of the offense in order to proceed and get a conviction on the bodily injury. However, the instrumentality of the offense needs to be cited in the indictment. As defense counsel going to trial, I certainly have a understanding of where I think the Commonwealth is going to go with their case, but I don't know until trial whether or not they have enough evidence to proceed under wounding or bodily injury. It doesn't become apparent until the trial date that, okay, their evidence is going towards a bodily injury aspect rather than the wounding. So it doesn't become apparent that there's a defect in the indictment until that time.
Well, how in a case of that nature would it ever become apparent before the trial?
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
How in a case such as that with malicious wounding would it ever be apparent before trial that you should move to quash the indictment or move to strike the indictment? Bring to the trial court's attention prior to trial that there's a defect with the indictment, because you're never going to hear the Commonwealth's case before you get to the time of trial.
Well, the way I read the rule is that it's my understanding if there's a defect in the indictment, say with the timing of the offense, if it lists an incorrect date or perhaps an incorrect location within the jurisdiction, that's certainly a defect I would have knowledge of beforehand that I would then notify the court about and file a motion to bring it before the court and have the indictment remedied. But as far as the nature of the offense before the court, it didn't become apparent until the actual trial date that they were proceeding with what I deemed to be a bodily injury case and not a wounding case so much, and then made my motion in that regard. Your Honor, I would also note the case law in Dawkins and Johnson, which I'm sure the court is thoroughly familiar with, emphasizes that the Commonwealth needs to utilize proper care in drawing the indictments, and it notes in those cases that this should not be an issue provided that proper care is taken in the drawing of these indictments. Now, Your Honor has made reference to Rule 3A:9. I know the Commonwealth in its brief also made reference to several statutes. I believe I've addressed Rule 3A:9 and move on to the statutes brought up by the Commonwealth, 19.2-220, which is the general contents of indictments statute, which pretty much states the purpose of indictments is to advise the defendant of the nature and character of the offense with which he's charged. Ordinarily, an indictment sufficiently charges an offense if it follows the language of the statute. But I believe in Sims v. Commonwealth, it also states that this rule doesn't apply when a statute doesn't fully set forth the material elements of the offense. In this case, I would argue that the instrumentality of the offense is a material element. Again, bodily injury is what has occurred here. Causing a bodily injury, the material element of the offense being, we need to know, was it with fists, feet, knees, can be implied in use of striking, punching, something like that, that kind of language. Commonwealth also would rely on 19.2-226, which is a curative statute to cure the omission of surplusage or words of form. I would suggest to the court that the language that is missing from the indictment is not just mere words of form. Again, has a direct correlation to the proof that needs to be presented to the court, the nature of the offense, the causality of the offense, and the instruments causing that injury.
Let me ask you this, and you referred to some of the statutes involved here in 19.2-220 and 19.2-221.
Yes, sir.
Do they effectively overrule Johnson's requirement, Johnson being 1945 case, that the indictment needs to include the means of causing bodily injury?
Your Honor, I would argue they don't, simply because I looked for case law to that effect, showing that the statute does overrule that, and I found none. Now, 19.2-221, I believe, is a statute for the short form for murder and manslaughter indictment, so I didn't believe it applied here, given this is a malicious wounding or bodily injury charge. I did look for case law to that effect, Your Honor, and I did not find any. So I would suggest that the case law is still good. With that being said, would argue that there is sufficient evidence for a bodily injury charge, but this charge wasn't properly brought before the trial court. The indictment is certainly proper for a malicious or unlawful wounding charge, but the evidence doesn't meet that burden. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Stallard.
Good morning,
sir.
Court. My name is Craig Stallard on behalf of the Commonwealth. To start, Your Honor, with Judge Beal's question, while there is no case law saying that the statute overrules the prior case law, I think it's clear to the extent there was a common law requirement that that be included in the indictment, that was abrogated by these statutes, saying that all that the statute needs to do is to recite the language of the statute, which was done in this case. The language of the statute is in the indictment, which makes it a proper indictment under the code. In addition, as it is a proper indictment, to the extent there's an issue regarding instrumentality for which he needs to be put on notice for, I think the Sims case he relies on talks more about a bill of particulars being the remedy, not a defect in the indictment. That's something he could have filed for, could have requested, you know, look, I'm not sure what you mean by this, I need more information. Then it would be up to the discretion of the trial judge to say, okay, yeah, give him more information or whatever.
Why wouldn't it be fair, though, for him to go into trial saying, all right, this is the indictment. The indictment alleges malicious wounding, and hold you to those claims. So why would he want to even raise that with a bill of particulars if he figures you're not going to be able to prove that case?
Well, the issue is, I guess, regarding the indictment, is to put the defendant on notice as to what he has to defend.
Right.
If he has a legitimate question as to what it is he needs to be defending, he can seek for a bill of particulars,
right,
and say, look, in order to put on a defense, I have to know what my client's charged with. I need more information.
But there's nothing wrong, is there, with the defense having it as a matter of strategy?
Yes, I agree. There's a tactical reason if he doesn't want to alert the Commonwealth to particular defense, he doesn't have to. But I don't think instrumentality is a material element of the offense. So if that's his argument, since they failed to allege instrumentality, I'm going to win. I don't think that's an accurate statement of the law. To the extent he's got a legitimate notice issue, there's a different remedy, which is a bill of particulars, as opposed to moving to strike the indictment or whatever which was done in this case. Additionally, even with the bill of particulars, I don't know, the record's not clear whether or not there was, in fact, a preliminary hearing, but my understanding is Mr. Conway doesn't deny causing the injuries. I'm assuming he spoke with his client. He has some idea of what Mr. Conway did. So even before trial, he has some information that this resulted from striking the victim with blows with a fist. So that's not really a surprise, I would think, by the time we get to trial.
What do we do with that language from Harris versus Commonwealth, 1928, that's been picked up and put in the treatise that's widely recognized here?
Well, I think the code amendments in the 1970s regarding 19.2.220 saying that the indictment only has to track the language of the statute or as much of the common law definition as to give notice. I think that abrogates the common law. To the extent there was a common law requirement that that be included in the 30s, 40s, the most recent case I found citing any of that was, I think, 1969. Since these amendments in 1970, I'm not familiar with any case dealing with instrumentality at all regarding malicious wounding. Also, this court in Johnson and the Supreme Court case in Burkeen, which I did not cite in my brief, but is 286 Virginia 255. Both of those cases deal with an assault with a blow to the fist to the victim. And in both of these cases, the courts consistently refer to that as a wounding, which, if instrumentality was an issue, would be an incorrect statement of what that was. Now, that could either be sloppiness on part of the court, or it could be a determination that wounding the instrumentality aspect is no longer material. What's at issue is the type of injury resulting. A wounding involves a breaking of the skin. Clearly that happened in this case, that happened in Burkine, that happened in Johnson, as opposed to it being both a fist as opposed to a weapon. I think the key issue now is a bodily injury is something that's where there's no breaking of skin, either broken bone, bruising, swelling, soft tissue damage, whereas a wounding necessitates a breaking of the skin. I think that is the state of the law. I'm not aware of any cases that require that a wounding be done with a weapon as opposed to a bodily injury being done with something belonging to the human body, a fist, knee, leg, foot, whatever it may be. So to the extent that was ever the issue, I think this code section abrogated that and said, no, we don't need to do that anymore.
Well, the code section dealt with the specificity that's required for the indictment, right? But in the context of a motion to strike, for example, if the allegation has been a malicious wounding, and if we were to use the that 1928 dicta, if that's what it is, that a wounding would require an use of an instrumentality other than body parts.
Now, yeah, I agree. There is a difference between what constitutes a sufficient indictment and what constitutes appropriate proof to establish the elements. Now, my understanding is he's challenging the indictments. To the extent he is challenging the law or the amount of evidence presented to establish instrumentality, again, the Commonwealth only has to prove what's in the indictment. And for example, they have to prove the intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill.
Right.
That's what the statute. That's what the statute says. However, the case law says it has to be an intent to permanently maim, disfigure, disable. The word permanently is not in the statute, but it is part of the case law requiring proof. So you can't have elements of proof that aren't specifically in the indictment. But in this case, instrumentality, to my knowledge, has never been a required element of proof since the 1970s. I'm not aware of any case where they've held, you failed to allege this was done with a weapon, you failed to allege this was done with a fist, a blow, whatever, therefore you've failed to meet your burden. I'm not aware of any case that requires that. I'm not aware of any case that's been reversed because of that or any case that's been affirmed because they did it properly. I believe what has happened as a result of the 1970 amendments, and I just think the natural flow of the cases, is the more important issue is the nature of the injuries, either a wounding involving breaking of the skin, or bodily injury being basically everything else. As long as you do that maliciously with the proper intent, you have violated the statute and you have a felony assault, which is what happened here. He assaulted him and struck him at least three times in the face, breached the skin, bruising, hemorrhage in both eyes. That is a malicious wounding. It was properly indicted. The Commonwealth's burden of proof was sufficient to establish the elements of the crime, and he was properly convicted. Now, I understand the older cases have some language in it which might be troubling. But I think, again, because of the amendments in the 70s and the fact, I'm not aware of any case. I'm not saying they don't exist, but I tried to find one, and I could not find any case that has the exact same language. Like, the most recent one I had was 1969, I think. But since that time, that's never been a requirement that I'm aware of, that the Commonwealth had to establish that. There's never been anything in the appellate courts dealing with it, to my knowledge. Based on the totality, it appears that that's no longer a material element of the offense. It was, again, because it was properly indicted and it was a proper offense, I think the 3A9 issue that the judge raised was appropriate because it was an offense for which he could be tried. Therefore, he should have raised this prior to trial if there's a problem with the indictment. Again, if there's a notice issue, there's a different remedy, which is bill of particulars. Which again,
given what you just said, let me ask you the question I ask Mr. Hubbard. Given his assignment of error 3 and the rule requirements of rule 3A:9, and the fact that was not addressed, does that essentially moot the first two assignments of error here that deal with the motion to strike the sufficiency of evidence?
I think to the extent his motion to strike is based on something lacking in the indictment, I think that is moot because that should have been raised prior to trial because the indictment still alleged an offense for which he could be tried, which is the one exception to raising that trial, which is the indictment is so defective that it doesn't actually charge a defense. You can raise that at trial. That's not the case here. This indictment exactly tracks the language of the statute, which is all that's required under 19.2-20. So it's a validly done indictment. Therefore, any other potential defects in it needed to be raised prior to trial, which was not done. And there's a reason for that, which is you get liberal leave for amendment, any errors, the trial court's got an opportunity to fix them. So it makes no sense to play gamesmanship, essentially, with the indictment. It's either so defective you can't go to trial, and you can raise that at trial because nobody's going to be surprised. This is just so bad we can't go forward. But if it's a problem that can be fixed, the Commonwealth has the opportunity to fix it, which is why you have the 7-day requirement. And that's why also liberal leave the statute permits liberal leave to amend, and because we want to be able to fix these errors at the time.
Did you say that you did find a 1969 case in which an instrumentality was required for the infliction of malicious wounds?
I think there's a 1960 case which cited other cases which referred to that. To be honest, right now, I just remember the date. It might be Fletcher versus Commonwealth, I think. I'm not positive on that. If the court's interested, I can let you know after this. I can try to find that again, Your Honor. But I was looking for something since the amendments were passed, and I found nothing since that happened. If the court has no further questions, I'd ask.
You said the date of that case?
I believe it was 1969. I would ask the court to affirm if you have no further questions.
Very well. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hubbard?
Mr. Hubbard, may I ask you to try and clear something up for me?
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
In looking at your assignments of error in your opening brief, and we've heard some argument today about sufficiency of the evidence versus sufficiency of the indictment.
Yes, sir.
In looking at your assignments of error, it refers to that there was error in the court not striking the Commonwealth's case and the indictment.
Yes, sir.
But I was under the understanding that in your petition for appeal, your assignments didn't speak to the Commonwealth's case, just to the indictments. Am I correct on that, or am I mistaken?
Well, I believe it also speaks to the sufficiency of the evidence, in that my argument it doesn't their case doesn't prove a wounding. Which I argue the definition being the external breach of the skin by cause of a weapon other than that which is endowed by man, again, being not the fists or the knees or something like that. So I believe it addresses that peripherally, but it does focus more on the indictment argument.
Is the language the same in those assignments of error, or is it different between your petition for appeal and the opening brief? Do you know?
I believe it's the same.
Do you have the wording of that, of the assignment of error that was granted, just so we're not taken off track on that?
I don't have it with me, Your Honor. I believe it's in my other materials.
All right, thank you.
So I apologize. The only point I wanted to touch on in rebuttal, Your Honors, is the Burkeen case, which was brought up by Mr. Stallard, and which he points to as being representative of malicious wounding covering not only the injuries caused by a weapon, but those caused by fists. And I would point the court to page 3 of that case, paragraph 3, if the court has copies of that, where it states that to be convicted of malicious wounding, the Commonwealth must prove that the defendant maliciously stabbed, cut, or wounded any person, or by any means caused him bodily injury in the disjunctive, with the intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill. What I propose to the court is that the term malicious wounding is more one of summary and title, saying, okay, malicious wounding is the charge, and it encompasses malicious wounding, malicious bodily injury, unlawful wounding, unlawful bodily injury. And I think the paragraph here in this case is consistent with that.
Thank you,
Your Honors.
Thank you. In keeping with the tradition of the court, we will come down and greet counsel in